Welcome to the podcast for the LSE Library exhibition Journeys to Independence, hosted in partnership with the LSE South Asia Centre. I'm Sonali Campion, Communications and Events Officer at the South Asia Centre, and I'm joined here by Daniel Payne from the Library, who curated the exhibition, and LSE Archivist Sue Donnelly. The South Asia Centre was founded in June 2015, and the exhibition is a key part of our activities to mark 70 years of Indian and Pakistani independence from British colonial rule. This year, we have held LSE summits in Delhi and Karachi, creating international platforms in the region to discuss issues of contemporary importance. We also held a series of Colony as Empire speaker events here in London, which explored the presence of colonial India in the British historical understanding of itself. Finally, we supported student societies to hold conferences on the future of Pakistan, India as an emerging superpower, and South Asian development. We will be holding a series of lectures with international academics in Michaelmas term. These will touch on subjects such as the Radcliffe Boundary Commission and post-independence transformations. All of the talks will be followed by a reception in the exhibition hosted by the Library, so do check out the links on the podcast page or at lse.ac.uk/South Asia. Now let me hand over to Daniel, who will tell you more about the exhibition itself.
Thanks, Sonali. So as Sonali mentioned, my name is Daniel and I work in the Library as the curator for the Politics and International Relations collections. Each year, the Library puts on three exhibitions in order to showcase some of the unique items that we hold in our archives. We also organise a number of events related to the exhibitions, so do have a look on the Library exhibition webpage. And this term's exhibition looks at some of the 20th century British archives we have related to India, Pakistan and Bangladesh. It covers the civil disobedience movement, British women activists and the founding of Pakistan and Bangladesh. There's also a table which looks at LSE's relationship with these countries.
And Sue, could you tell us a little bit about LSE's relationship with the Indian subcontinent?
LSE has very long-standing links with the Indian subcontinent. Its very first South Asian student signed up in Michaelmas term 1895, and that relationship has continued to the present day. Amongst staff, the director William Beveridge was born in India, as was the economic historian R.H. Tawney. And the economist Vera Anstey, who taught here until the 1960s, had lived and worked in India in the 1920s. And in the post-independence world, in 1984, I.G. Patel, who'd been president of the Reserve Bank of India, became director of LSE.
So Daniel, on your right as you enter the exhibition, we have a video wall with images and scanned archive materials and five boards with different stories and physical documents relating to what you discovered in the archives. The story of birth control activists who travelled to India and met Gandhi particularly caught my eye. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, so I actually accidentally came across these documents when I started doing the research for the exhibition. The first thing I did was take the fairly obvious step of looking for any material that we might have by Gandhi himself. As I'm sure most people know, Gandhi was the leader of the Indian independence movement. And the first thing I came across was a letter in the archives by Gandhi, which was addressed to somebody called Edith Howe Martin, who I'd not heard of before. And in this letter, it's quite a short letter, which is on display in the exhibition. And Gandhi says the following. He says, "I'm quite at one with you that women are the greater sufferer in this matter, only the remedy suggested is worse than the disease." And when I read this, I wasn't really sure what it was about or what the context of it was. So I did some further digging, and it seems we have a collection of diaries and correspondence authored by Edith Howe Martin, as well as a person called Eileen Palmer. And both these women worked for an organisation called the Birth Control Information Centre, which was founded in London in 1928, I think. And this was a birth control activist organisation. So they campaigned for birth control, published pamphlets, organised conferences, etc. This organisation also merged with various other organisations and became what is today the Family Planning Association. I also think Edith studied at the LSE, is that right, Sue?
Yes, she did. She was actually here from 1908 to 1926, and she got her first degree, specialising in public administration, in 1916, and then in 1922 she completed a master's degree.
Their work took them to India, and we have diaries of their travels there, Eileen Palmer's diaries, and they met Gandhi and they talked to him about birth control, which might seem like a strange topic to be approaching Gandhi about, but as Edith writes herself, the opinions of a man who almost single-handedly has challenged the imperial power of Britain as it holds power in India are considered well worth having. So when Gandhi in his letter mentions the remedy suggested is worse than the disease, he's referring here to birth control methods, artificial birth control methods, which he was very much against. Edith and others associated with the centre were obviously highly critical of Gandhi's stance on this point. Again, as Edith writes, "Mr. Gandhi will have nothing to do with birth control. He regards it as a sin, as a temptation to mankind to pander to his lower nature, as an invention of the devil to lure men and women from the path of renunciation." If you're interested in finding out a bit more about these women and their activism in India, we have a public lecture about it on the 31st of October. If you're listening to this after that date, there will also be a podcast of it available.
And which was the story that you found most interesting in the course of your research?
So I'd probably say the story of Madeline Slade was my favourite story when I was researching. I actually discovered this also by accident when I was looking up the civil disobedience movement. So often I found that I'd be looking for something specific in the archives, and the thing that I found accidentally ended up becoming the story, if that makes sense. So Madeline Slade, or as she was called by Gandhi later, Meera Behn, meaning Sister Meera, she led a really extraordinary life. She was a very controversial figure in Britain for various reasons. She was born into the British elite in 1892. Her father was an admiral. He was posted to India, and she spent about a year of her childhood in India. And when she was 15, something life-changing happened. She heard a Beethoven sonata. I haven't managed to figure out which sonata it was, but she heard one and she became obsessed with it. She said it was the most beautiful thing she'd ever heard. So much so that shortly after the First World War, she registered as a concert agent in London, and she assisted the cause of racial tolerance by promoting Germanic music. She helped bring about an end of the British boycott of German musicians. She came across a French biographer of Beethoven, Romain Rolland, who she wanted to meet and discuss Beethoven with. But before doing so, she wanted to live in France so she could master French and read the book in the original, which is exactly what she did. And through meeting him, she learned about another biography that he'd written of Gandhi. And for her, when reading this, her interest in this Beethoven sonata were replaced by Gandhi. She became fascinated by him. So she writes to Gandhi in 1924 and asks him if she can come and work and stay with him in his ashram in India. Which Gandhi agrees to, but Madeline says she wants to undergo a year's training first. So she moved to Switzerland and worked in the hayfields to prepare herself for work in the ashram. And then, shortly before her 33rd birthday, she said goodbye to her parents, which would be the last time she saw them, and she moves to India, and she's by Gandhi's side for the next 20 years, or over 20 years, and helped him in the cause for an independent India. We have a couple of archives of hers on display. I'll just talk about one of them. So there's one that she wrote shortly before she was imprisoned for her support of Indian independence, which she wrote in 1932. This document is called Read, Realize, Act. And she finishes this document with the following, which I'll just read out. "There is one golden rule for resisting an evil in which one and all can cooperate, rich and poor, young and old, and that is complete boycott of all things tainted with that evil. We should not touch a single thing which supports this British Raj. That will bring this system to an end quicker than anything else. And then, and only then, can we lift from our heads the shame which is at present ours."
The archives are obviously very extensive, so you've had to be very selective. What was the most challenging part of curating this exhibition?
So there were lots of things about it that were challenging. When I started to kind of research and select the documents, that was actually the thing I found the most difficult. I quickly became very conscious of the fact that a huge amount of the story that's implied by the title of the exhibition is actually left out. Really, the archives that we have, they weren't deliberately collected in order to document the struggles for independence in these countries. Rather, they tell some of these struggles, but kind of incidentally rather than purposefully, which I think is an important difference. So as a result, the stories that we do have seem to be fairly random, they're exclusionary, and they're also biased. So, for example, India made a huge contribution to Britain's war efforts, both in the First and Second World Wars, but we don't really have any archives that relate to that specifically, so it's left out of the exhibition. It's also more problematic by the fact that the archives that we do have are inescapably British, so they were produced and collected by British people, organisations and MPs, etc. I think to answer your question about what was the most challenging thing, for me it was to try and figure out how to tell something about the story of the journeys to independence using archives that kind of don't. And there isn't really a solution to this, I don't think. I thought about borrowing archives from other institutions to kind of fill out the story where we have gaps. But in the end, I decided not to. I think it's important when you look at any archival document that as well as the story the document is telling, there is always another story going on, the story of the physical document itself. So how did it get here? Who collected it? Why is it here? And why are other things not here? The other thing I tried to do was to tell aspects of the British relationship to these countries through slightly unusual or unexpected stories that visitors might not know about. So, for example, I'd tell the story of Madeleine Slade as a way of talking about the civil disobedience movement, or I would tell the story of Edith Howe Martin as a way of talking about Gandhi. You'll also see at the end of the exhibition, I talk about the story of Labour MP Peter Shaw as a way of talking about independence in Bangladesh. Whilst we're marking this year as the 70th anniversary of partition, I felt that it was important to include the story of Bangladesh. From spending so much time with these archives, it seemed to me that it didn't really make sense to look at partition as this one single event that happened in 1947, but rather to look at it as a much more complicated story that started literally hundreds of years ago and still isn't finished. And so it was for that reason I wanted to include a story post-partition.
Over here we have a table with material showcasing LSE's ties with the Indian subcontinent. Sue, perhaps you could start by telling me about the students who came from South Asia and their involvement in university life.
As I said earlier, the very first South Asian student was Adi Chand, who registered for study at the school's first term in Michaelmas 1895. I think LSE's course of study, which it advertised as being suitable for people who wanted to go into business, into banking, into the law, into the civil service, and indeed into the Indian civil service, were very attractive to students from South Asia. And also, unlike Oxford and Cambridge, it didn't demand that its students knew any Latin, which was also a bar for many to studying in the UK at the time. In 1913, Manilal Subedar was the first of the South Asian students to obtain a first-class degree here at LSE. And it's also true that in 1912, LSE Students' Union elected its first Indian president, and that was Nandlal Mazumdar. It wasn't all men students either. In 1920, when the foundation stone of the old building was laid, a woman student, Mitan Ardashir Tata, was one of two students selected to meet George V and Queen Mary. She was part of the platform party and presented them with the time capsule to be laid under the foundation stone. And when she returned to India, she practiced at the bar and was to become the first woman law professor in India.
There are a number of names and faces on the timeline that will be recognisable to both British and South Asian visitors. How did Ratan Tata come to be involved with LSE so early in its history?
Yes, that's an interesting example of the way in which links with India and the United Kingdom at this time are perhaps more complex than many people realise. Sir Ratan Tata, who was the son of the founder of the Tata business, originally wanted to establish a school of social science in Bangalore, but his offer to fund such an institution was rejected by the British government in India. And instead, he approached the University of London with an offer to fund research into what he termed poverty, pauperism, and the causes and effects thereof. The offer to the University of London coincided with a long visit to India by Sidney and Beatrice Webb, And they met Surat and Tata, and Beatrice Webb noted in her diary that the reason for the rejection was that the British government in India is so afraid of any intellectual development among the Indians because it finds that intellectual development always leads to a desire for self-government. Because of LSE's work in economics and sociology, it was the obvious location for the research work that Rat and Tata wanted to support. The first appointment to the Rat and Tata Foundation was made in 1912, and that was the economic historian R.H. Tawney. And funding continued right until 1932, when the Department of Social Science and Administration was well established within the school and was in fact the precursor of today's social policy department.
Perhaps the first thing you notice when you walk into the exhibition is the bronze bust of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, Chief Architect of the Indian Constitution and First Minister of Law and Justice in independent India. When was he at LSE?
We're lucky to have Ambedkar's student file so that we know that he actually came to LSE twice. Briefly in 1916, when he signed up to do a Master's in Economics, but was recalled to India because of the First World War. He returned in 1920 intending to complete his Master's thesis, but in the end he produced a doctorate supervised by Edwin Cannon, who was then Professor of Political Economy. Ambedkar submitted a doctoral thesis entitled The Problem of the Rupee in March 1923. Initially, the thesis was rejected, and the story has been told that this was because it was deemed to be very anti-British. However, the thesis was accepted later in 1923, and Ambedkar got his doctorate. And the student file gives no indication as to why it was initially rejected, and it seems to have been little changed. LSE did keep in touch with Ambedkar and certainly followed his career, and when he was in London for the Round Table conferences in the 1930s, both Cannon and the director, William Beveridge, made contact with him.
Finally, I notice on the timeline that there's a photo of Krishna Menon in his tennis whites. Could you tell me more about his student days?
Yes, Krishna Menon came the following year from Ambedkar leaving. He studied at LSE from 1924 to 1927, and he got first-class honours in his BSc Economics, specialising in the history of political ideas. This course of study would have brought him into close contact with Harold Laski, whose political thought is often cited as a great influence on the first independent Indian government led by Nehru. And indeed, from 1930 to 1947, Laski was president of the India League. Unfortunately, we don't have a surviving student file for Krishna Menon, but the photographic record seems to indicate that he played an active part in LSE's sports and social life, and there are indeed several photographs of him at tennis parties down at the New Malden sports fields.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. You can obviously come and visit the exhibition and see these exhibits and more from the 18th of September to the 15th of December 2017. You will also find on the LSE History blog and the LSE South Asia blog a series of posts relating to some of the characters we've discussed today, as well as posts relating to other materials from the archives. You can find more information about the exhibition and associated events on the podcast page.